Halloween decorations have a certain charm, which is hats hanging from porches, fabric ghosts fluttering in the breeze, the occasional creepy prop dangling from a tree. From a distance, they're part of the fun, harmless, meant to make us smile or shiver just a little. But on one October day in 2005, residents in Frederica, Delaware, noticed a decoration along a fairly busy road that some felt was in poor taste. A figure hanging from a tree. Its head was tilted forward, and it swayed with each gust of wind. Neighbors sipped their morning coffee and shook their heads, amused and impressed at the realism. The prop was so realistic that drivers slowed down to glance, causing a distraction for those not paying close enough attention. Hours passed, and the figure remained. Eventually, someone felt the decoration went a little too far and notified the police with a complaint. When police finally arrived, the truth quickly spread. What everyone had been gawking at all morning while eating their cereal and drinking their coffee was in fact a flesh and blood person, leaving viewers with the most haunting image burned into their memory. The police investigation determined it was a body of a 42-year-old woman who had taken her own life. You see, on Halloween, we expect our scares to be fake, but sometimes the horror is real, and urban legends are born. And in tonight's episode, the horror doesn't hang in plain sight. It hides behind the mask of normalcy and is discovered when you least expect it. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Unlocking the Paranormal. I am your host, Carrie. Now, when we think back to the October morning in Delaware, the line between make-believe, fright, and grim reality was shattered. What should have been a harmless illusion revealed itself to be true horror. And that's the unsettling nature of Halloween, isn't it? For one night a year, we're willing to invite fear to our doorsteps, knocking, smiling, and disguised in masks. We hand out candy without a second thought, trusting that this tradition is safe, innocent, and untouched by real danger. But what if the nightmare didn't come from a lifelike decoration or a shadow lurking in the dark? What if it slipped into our homes in the form of a sweet, brightly wrapped piece of candy, given to a child by an unsuspecting hand? That very fear gave rise to one of Halloween's darkest urban legends. The legend of the man who killed Halloween. The legend of the Candyman. This legend begins on Halloween night, Thursday, October 31st, 1974. A light drizzle slicked the pavement, but it didn't stop the trick-or-treaters. The streets were alive with laughter, costumes, and the rustling of candy bags in the dark. That evening, Ronald O'Brien loaded his two children, Timothy, aged 8, and Elizabeth, age 5, into the car around 7 p.m. Though they lived in Deer Park, Texas, they drove to the nearby town of Pasadena to meet family friends and begin their trick-or-treating route through the Bowling Green subdivision. Joining them was Ronald's friend Jim Bates, along with his own children, Mark, age 8, Timothy's classmate, and Kimberly, age 11. Now, the weather was far from ideal. The rain had settled in heavy enough that Ronald almost called off the night altogether. But, in the end, they decided to let the kids enjoy just a short taste of Halloween. No more than 30 minutes of fun. A decision that would soon take a sinister turn. Timothy's grandmother, Mrs. Ellis, recalled that Ronald and the children returned home from trick-or-treating around 8 p.m. What began as an ordinary Halloween night quickly unraveled into horror. Within just 2 hours and 40 minutes of arriving home, Timothy lay dead at Southmore Hospital. According to Ronald, Timothy had gone to the bathroom when he suddenly began convulsing, vomiting, and gasping for air, before going completely limp. An ambulance was called, but by 10:40 p.m., Timothy was pronounced dead. After speaking with the O'Briens, investigators immediately suspected that poison candy was to blame. The possibility that the other children could have picked up tainted sweets sent shockwaves through the neighborhood. That night, panic spread from house to house as police and neighbors worked frantically, staying awake until nearly 2:30 in the morning to warn every family who might still have Halloween candy in their possession. Halloween night had turned from playful laughter and candy bags into whispers of poison treats and a community gripped by fear. By the following day, Deer Park Police Lieutenant A.L. Marquez confirmed that no other reports of children falling ill from Halloween candy had surfaced. But if not the candy, then what killed Timothy? His grandmother insisted he was a perfectly normal, healthy third grader. His father described him as active, full of energy, a live wire. The Harrison County Medical Examiner scheduled an autopsy to determine whether the candy played a role in his death. Tests were also run on the treats Timothy carried home that night. Among them, a single giant pixie stick, which Ronald claimed was the last thing his son had eaten. Curiously, Ronald mentioned that just earlier that day, Timothy had gotten sick after eating some sweet tarts and had thrown up. At first, Ronald insisted he never considered candy could have been the cause of Tim's death, until the police provided the results of the autopsy. The Harrison County Medical Examiner's Office confirmed the unthinkable. Tim had died from cyanide poisoning. The sweet, brightly colored pixie stick he had eaten concealed a hidden death. Cyanide is one of the most lethal chemical compounds known. When swallowed in large enough doses, it shuts down the body in moments. Police Lieutenant E.L. Goad revealed that Timothy's pixie stick wasn't the only one. Several other sticks handed out to the children who trick-or-treated alongside Tim were also tainted. When the O'Brien family turned over the remaining pixie stick that was given to Elizabeth, police discovered it had been deliberately tampered with. They also tested the other tubes that the other children had been given. Each tube carried enough poison to kill not just a child, but 2 or 3 grown men. Dr. Joseph Tchimsek, and I know for certain I'm probably saying that wrong, Harrison County's medical examiner, reported that the top 2 inches of Timothy's 22-inch long pixie stick were packed with potassium cyanide. What should have been harmless sugar in flavor had been transformed into a silent weapon, disguised as candy, waiting for a child's eager hands to tear it open. Police immediately notified every school in Pasadena and Deer Park, warning children not to eat a single piece of Halloween candy. Parents who had collected candy in the Bowling Green subdivision were told to bring it straight to the detective division of the Pasadena Police Department. The question on everyone's mind was chilling. Who would want to poison innocent children? He was 8 years old. At that age, a third grader, you're still wide-eyed, trusting, untouched by the world's darkness. Was Timothy deliberately chosen? Or had this horror been meant for any child unlucky enough to tear open the wrong wrapper? On Friday, November 1st, police began retracing the O'Brien family's steps. They went door to door, through the quiet neighborhood, piecing together the events of Halloween night. Behind each door was a family, now gripped with fear. Fear that their own child could have been the next to taste death disguised as candy. Now, investigators leaned heavily on Ronald, pressing him to recount every detail of Halloween night, piece by piece. He began to unravel the evening's events. According to Ronald, the group set out trick-or-treating around 7:30 p.m. But the outing was cut short, barely 30 minutes long, because of the steady rain. Back at home, the children weren't allowed to touch their candy until bedtime. Then, as a small treat before lights out at 9 p.m., Ronald permitted each child to choose one piece of candy. Timothy reached for the giant pixie stick. He complained almost immediately about its strange bitter taste. To ease the unpleasant flavor, Ronald fetched him a glass of Kool-Aid. Moments later, the night turned to horror. Barely 30 seconds after Ronald left the room, Timothy cried out, "Daddy, Daddy, my stomach hurts." He staggered towards the bathroom, where he began vomiting, convulsing, and finally collapsed into his father's arms. An ambulance was called in desperation, rushing Timothy to Southmore General Hospital in Pasadena. But it was too late. At 10:40 p.m., an 8-year-old was pronounced dead. His Halloween night ended not with candy and laughter, but with poison and silence. In an emotional interview, Ronald choked back tears as he described his son. A true boy's boy, full of energy and life. He loved football, basketball, and just about anything that kept him moving. Ronald added, through shaky words, that Timothy never met a stranger. For the Bates family, the horror came chillingly close. Their eldest son had begged for a pixie stick that Halloween night. His mother, weary of cleaning up after the children, refused, assuming the candy would be spilled on the ground or into the carpet. By sheer chance, the tainted candy remained untouched on their counter. The next day, after hearing the devastating news of Timothy's death, they turned it over to police when officers came knocking. But the question remained, where had the poisoned pixie stick come from? Ronald struggled to recall the exact house where the candy had been handed out, his memory hazy at best. Adding to the mystery, investigators were puzzled by another unsettling detail. Why had so few children in the neighborhood received the giant pixie stick that night? Only the O'Briens and the Bates children, who were together, seemed to have been given them. Authorities noted that this particular candy was relatively expensive to hand out, raising a sinister question. Was this an attack targeted at one family? Or had some faceless hand scattered death into the candy bags of children at random? Then came another chilling call. A Houston mother reported that her 4-year-old son had been handed a candy bar laced with a razor blade while trick-or-treating at an apartment complex in Spring Branch, a suburb of Houston. Not long after, a 14-year-old boy bit into a Longboy chocolate bar, only to feel the sharp sting of a hidden pin piercing his upper lip. When his mother inspected the rest of his candy, she discovered a second bar with a pin lodged into one end. Though police determined these cases weren't connected, each occurring in separate suburbs around Houston, the fear spread all the same. Candy, the symbol of childhood joy on Halloween night, had become a vessel of hidden violence. Behind every wrapper, parents now feared there could be something sharp, or worse yet, something deadly. On Sunday, November 3rd, police continued their painstaking canvas of the horseshoe-shaped residential street that had been part of the children's trick-or-treating route. Officers knocked on every door, determined to uncover who had laced Halloween candy with deadly poison. Many officers worked tirelessly on the case, even on their day off, driven by the urgency of the hunt. The subdivision had 48 homes in total, and at that point, a few residents had yet to be interviewed. Neighbors were shaken to their core. People who had lived side by side for years, who knew each other well, now eyed one another with suspicion. Could someone they trusted have deliberately harmed children? One resident whispered a chilling theory. Perhaps a stranger had broken into a vacant home, distributed poison candy in the dark, turning the night of laughter and costumes into a sinister trap. In the quiet streets of Bowling Green, the shadow of terror had settled, and no one felt safe. By Monday, November 4th, at 11:55 p.m., just minutes before midnight, police finally had their man. They arrested none other than Timothy's father, Ronald O'Brien. But what evidence could possibly point to him? At that point, authorities were tight-lipped, unwilling to reveal the details as they worked to tie up every loose end. On the surface, Ronald seemed like the picture of normalcy. He was an optician by trade, a deacon at his local Baptist church, and a choir singer on Sundays. Neighbors described him as protective, devoted to Timothy, and Reverend Jimmy Jones noted that the family was deeply involved in church activities. A man like that, how could he commit such a monstrous act? When I first studied the case, part of me wasn't entirely shocked. History has shown that seemingly perfect, normal family men can harbor darkness. Yet the question remained, what dark secrets did the police uncover in their investigation? Were there threads that painted a far more sinister picture than anyone in the neighborhood could imagine? Or were the police so motivated to pick their guy, they targeted the wrong man? For the residents of Bowling Green, the revelation was chilling. The very man they had trusted, the very man who pointed the finger at that neighborhood as being dangerous, was now the prime suspect in poisoning their own child. The nightmare they feared on Halloween had come home, and it was closer than anyone could have imagined. By the following day, news outlets were abuzz with chilling revelations. Ronald had taken out $38,000 in life insurance on his two children just 5 days before Halloween. Police Captain R.E. Rhodes neither confirmed nor denied the claim, leaving the public to stew in a growing sense of dread. Let's fast forward to Tuesday, November 12th, during the preliminary hearing. This is where we begin to glimpse at the true events of that fateful Halloween night. Jim Bates testified for 1 hour and 15 minutes. Painting a picture that would send shivers through anyone listening. He stated that Ronald suggested bringing his children to the Bates' neighborhood for Halloween a week before the holiday had even arrived. They stuck two houses with porch lights on, stopping only where people were home. At one house, The lights are on, but no one answered the door. Now, I will just say quickly here, some reports stated that the lights were off at this house, but some stated that the lights were on, but no one answered. Either way, they went to a house, and no one answered the door. When Ronald returned from that house, his hands held something extraordinary. 5 giant pixie sticks. The kind of sugary treasure that children dreamed about. With a teasing smile, he said, "You've got rich neighbors. Look what they're giving." Jim testified it was the first time he had seen the candy. A few minutes later, they had returned to the Bates' home, where Ronald handed out some suckers he had taken from his car and 4 of the pixie sticks. The 5th was given to a young child who lived next door to the Bates family when he arrived at the door. These statements from Jim do leave a small possibility that someone did come to the door and Jim did not see them. Or Ronald could have concealed them, only taking them out until the right moment of opportunity. But the more testimony they heard, the more damning it got for Ronald. Mrs. Bates revealed that Daneen O'Brien, Timothy's mother, had confided in her about the family's financial struggles. Assistant District Attorney Mike Hinton explained that the grand jury's indictment of Ronald on capital murder charges claimed the alleged crime was motivated by money, specifically the life insurance policies on his children. 2 witnesses testified that Ronald had purchased a total of $61,000 in insurance on his children over the previous 11 months, with $40,000 of it coming into effect less than a month before Timothy's death. Robert Ballou Jr., one of the insurance agents, testified that he had grown up with Ronald. He offered a different policy that would pay more when the children became adults, but would only provide $5,000 immediately. Eugene Shepherd, a bank cashier at First Pasadena State Bank, testified that in January of that year, Ronald had enrolled himself, his wife, and his 2 children into a bank club that provided each family member with $10,000 accidental death policy. Both men testified that Ronald called them first thing the morning after Halloween to report Timothy's death. We are not talking even 24 hours later. We're talking hours later. As a parent, that detail sends a chill straight to the bone. The idea that a grieving father's first call would be about insurance is almost incomprehensible, turning the nightmare of that Halloween night even darker. Then came the testimony of a former coworker of Ronald's, a detail that sent shivers through everyone in the courtroom. Bob Terry, a former coworker of Ronald's at Arc Chemical, where Ronald had worked as a lab technician for a year, recalled a strange phone call from early September. Ronald asked him, point blank, how much cyanide it would take to kill someone. He wanted to know if just anyone can purchase it. But when Bob asked why he needed to know, the conversation abruptly ended. Ronald later explained that he had been taking a chemistry course at San Jacinto Junior College and had been curious about a discussion with his professor on cyanide. He claimed he was testing the professor's competence. Adding another layer of dread, a chemical salesman testified that Ronald had tried to buy potassium cyanide in late October though he did not complete the purchase after he found out that it was only sold in large quantities. Taken together, these details paint a chilling picture. Ronald had not only inquired about cyanide, he had actively tried to obtain it just weeks before his child's death from the exact same substance. Coincidences like this don't just happen, and yet the prosecution could not definitively prove that he ever purchased the deadly chemical. The unanswered question hung in the air. If he didn't buy it, then when and from where did the poison come from? And what about the house Ronald claimed had handed out the candy? What did the investigation uncover? During the preliminary hearing, Pasadena Detective William Lanier testified that the homeowners said a mother and her daughter were home on Halloween night, while the father was at work. They admitted they had forgotten to buy candy and were not answering the door. But in a case already steeped in suspicion, could they have been lying? Then, Ronald's brother Thomas was called to testify, more to shed light on Ronald's character than the events themselves. His testimony was far from favorable. He stated that Ronald had a history of struggling to keep a job and was in poor financial shape. In the end, Ronald was indicted on charges of poisoning his son and attempting to poison his daughter in order to collect $61,000 from life insurance policies. He was also charged with attempting to poison three other children in a cover. The district court judge refused to set bail, leaving him in custody as the nightmare loomed over the community. A trial date was scheduled for the following January, and the streets of Pasadena, once alive with laughter of children, now carried the lingering shadow of fear and betrayal. At this point, things were looking grim for Ronald, but the prosecution still had gaps. There was no proof he had actually purchased cyanide. There were no clear details on how he supposedly produced the pixie sticks out of nowhere. And the house he claimed had handed out the candy remained shrouded in uncertainty. Yet, the chilling question lingered. What were the odds that he inquired about cyanide, and then just weeks later, his child died from it? As the case unfolded, the defense fought to exclude a key prosecution witness, Thomas Jackson. Jackson had testified that Ronald had attempted to buy the cyanide from his company prior to Halloween, but had ultimately not completed the purchase. The defense argued that Jackson could not positively identify Ronald in photograph shown to him by the police in November, suggesting that law enforcement may have influenced him. Prosecutors countered that the point was irrelevant. Pasadena Police Detective Evelyn Lancaster testified that Jackson had not simply identified a photo. He recalled Ronald's optician's smock and his physical features with distinct clarity. But in a case as terrifying as this, was that really enough? The shadows of doubt and suspicion hung heavy over every detail, leaving the question of intent and evil looming over the community like the dark of a November night. The defense co-counsel also argued that police had confiscated Ronald's belongings without his consent. In response, officers stated they had received permission from Ronald's wife, Deneen. The items in question included residue vacuumed from the O'Brien family vehicle, a pair of scissors, and a pocket knife. But if there was truly nothing to find, why go to such lengths to challenge the seizure? Fast forward to May 1975. One of the Bates children, Mark, who had gone trick-or-treating with the group that Halloween, provided his recollection of the night events. He testified that at the house Ronald claimed handed out the poison candy, no one answered the door. He and Timothy rang the doorbell, shouted, "Trick-or-treat," and were met with silence. So they ran on to the next house. Jim Bates then testified that it was only after moving on that Ronald produced the pixie stick for the children. He recalled that Ronald described receiving the candy from a man with hairy arms and a bald spot on his head at the house. The detail was unusually specific, almost unnervingly so, as if Ronald felt compelled to fabricate a memory to cover something darker. Mark also stated that Ronald had taken the pixie sticks back and carried them to Mark's home before distributing it to the children, Timothy, his sister Elizabeth, Kimberly, and himself. Later, when a neighbor stopped by the Bates house, they too were handed a pixie stick. Prosecutors noted that Gene Melvin, the man who lived in the house Ronald claimed had handed out the candy, fit the description perfectly. Yet, investigators confirmed that he had been at work that night. There wasn't much more to go on as to how his alibi was confirmed, but they were certain that he was at work. Jean Bates, Jim Bates' wife, recalled that Ronald appeared unnervingly composed for a man who had just lost his son. He told her and her husband that he had identified the house and the man, but the man could prove that he had an alibi. Ronald remarked that he didn't see how the police could possibly solve the case. One can't help but wonder, did Ronald already know the man at the house? Did he somehow anticipate that the man would be at work, giving him an airtight alibi? Perhaps, but then again, it seems almost trivial in the context of a man plotting the deaths of his own children for money. Ronald's brother-in-law, John Tucker, testified that on the night of November 1st, Ronald claimed to have received a vision from God. In this vision, he said he saw a rough, working man's hand handing out the pixie stick. It was from this vision that Ronald said he was able to provide the police with both a description of the man and the house he lived in on November 2nd. To me, this raises a red flag. Could this man that he suddenly was able to envision simply be someone that attended the funeral? Someone that he knew was a neighbor and he had talked to him and picked him out as the fall guy? John recalled Ronald speaking about how he would spend the insurance money the day after Timothy's funeral. He asked whether he should pay bills or make a down payment on a house. He even offered to help John go through seminary school, though the offer was declined. His sister-in-law then claimed that he mentioned using the money for a vacation. The testimony painted a chilling portrait of a man consumed by money, already thinking about ways to spend it, even as his child lay in a grave. The callousness, the focus on a personal gain in the wake of a death, revealed a mind disturbingly capable of plotting a horror for profit. Somewhere along the line, investigators uncovered that Ronald was nearly $100,000 in debt, and he had held 21 different jobs over the past decade. Some reports even suggested that $12,000 had gone missing from Ronald's employer, nearly costing him his job, though the money was later found hidden behind a file cabinet. Could the money have been stashed away by Ronald? It really makes one wonder. if he were successful with killing both children, what was he planning with such a large payout at once? And even more so, what was he planning to do with his wife? John's wife, Doreen, testified that Ronald seemed almost gleeful at the thought of hearing Timothy's name in the news. He insisted that the whole family watch the coverage, an unsettling fascination with tragedy that raised many eyebrows. Then it was Ronald's wife, Danine, that took the stand. Though the defense preferred she not testify, she chose to. She admitted knowing about the initial accidental death policies Ronald had taken out in January, but claimed she was unaware of the additional policies arranged just days before Timothy's death. Then she described the night of the murder. According to Danine, the story of Timothy asking for a pixie stick was a little bit different than what she recalled. She stated that Ronald suggested it to him, then poured the contents straight down Timothy's throat. Her testimony detailed how Timothy initially said it tasted good, only to then complain after a second gulp. That's when Ronald went to get him a drink of Kool-Aid to wash it down. Pause for a moment and consider the horror of this. A father literally pouring poison candy down his son's throat. Any parent in this situation would likely be racked with guilt, questioning every choice. I know that I would feel guilty probably for the rest of my life, knowing that I helped my child go to the grave. The nightmare of that Halloween becomes almost unimaginable when you picture it from this perspective. So far, we've explored the testimony that could suggest a motive for Ronald's poisoning his own son. But if he did commit the act, how could he have carried it out? Jim Bates, who accompanied him that night, testified that Ronald didn't produce the pixie stick until after approaching the door of a house. And what about the candy itself? Wouldn't anyone have noticed if it had been tampered with? The young boy who stopped by the Bates home that night recalled trying to open one of the pixie sticks, but it was stapled shut. He had asked his father for help, but was told to go to bed. Later that evening, the nightmare became real. A child had died from eating poison candy. Gerald Zhang, vice president of the candy manufacturing firm, testified that pixie sticks are designed to be tamper-proof. Each tube is made with a tough, heat-sealed plastic that must be cut open. The remaining pixie sticks collected by authorities were all stapled shut, something the manufacturer would never have done. Zhang also testified that the news of Timothy's death had shaken his business profoundly. So, how had no one noticed the tampered candy earlier in the night? Well, let's recall. Ronald handed them out. He then took them back from the children before then redistributing them at the Bates' home. Was this a tactic so nobody would get a clear look? Was he worried that the kids would want to open them right then and there and die on the spot? It raises so many questions. Assistant District Attorney Mike Hinton demonstrated one possible method Ronald could have concealed a pixie stick by folding it inside his waistband. Another likely option, chilling in its own simplicity, would have been to slip the candy tubes into a pant leg tucked into a tall tube sock. It would have protected the sticks from bending and allowed him to withdraw them quietly and effortlessly at the perfect moment. Every detail of that night, from the careful concealment to the seemingly innocent handing out of candy, now carries the weight of deliberate, calculated horror. Throughout the trial, the prosecution pieced together a chilling portrait of Ronald O'Brien. Strangely calm. Too calm for a father who had just lost his son. Debt. Over $100,000. Drowning in overdue bills. Life insurance policies taken out on both children in the months leading up to Halloween, with another just days before Tim's death. Odd behavior. Former coworkers recalling Ronald asking how much cyanide it would take to kill someone. When investigators reconstructed the timeline, the conclusion was undeniable. The only person with opportunity to poison the pixie sticks was Ronald himself. This was not a random act of Halloween horror. It was calculated, cold. A father willing to sacrifice his own children for a payout. The prosecution dubbed him the Candyman, the man who killed Halloween. And yet, through it all, Ronald maintained his innocence. The jury deliberated for less than an hour. Guilty of capital murder. The judge sentenced Ronald O'Brien to death by lethal injection. On March 31st, 1984, nearly a decade later, Ronald was led to the execution chamber. Outside the prison, the crowd celebrated, some in costume, some chanting trick or treat. For them, justice had been served. Now, if you're still on the fence about his guilt, which I don't think you are, let's look closely at his final moments. While the drugs were administered, he never once spoke about Timothy or his daughter, his family that got ripped away from him. An innocent man, many would argue, would. Thanks to Ronald O'Brien, parents everywhere still inspect every wrapper, every treat. One man's greed forever tainted a night of childhood joy. Evil didn't come from a stranger's doorstep that Halloween. It came from the hand of a father, hidden behind the mask of a smile. This Halloween, remember the story of Ronald O'Brien. And remember, sometimes the real monsters don't lurk in the shadows of strangers. Sometimes they live in the places we feel safest. That is it for today's Halloween episode. Now, I'd love to hear from you guys. Do you believe that justice was served? Do you believe that Ronald was in fact the killer? I mean, the jury agreed that he was. Share your thoughts, share your feedback, and share whether you also check every piece of candy for your children on Halloween. Thank you for joining me on this chilling journey to unravel the mysteries of the unknown. For a full list of episode source material, head on over to the Unlocking the Paranormal Podcast Facebook page. And do follow the Instagram and TikTok for additional creepy content. Now, if you want to become a Paranormal Pen Pal and have one of your stories shared on a Paranormal Pen Pals episode, you can email your stories to unlockingtheparanormalpod@gmail.com, or you can call the haunt line. Don't forget to show your support by following the podcast and subscribing for free. This podcast is independently produced, so sharing it with any family or friends or anyone you know helps me immensely. Stay tuned for the next episode where we will venture further into the labyrinth of the supernatural. Until then, stay curious, embark on the journey, and may you find the key to unlocking the paranormal.